Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dot Foil Computer Services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with the poets Michelle LaFlamme-Childs and Gabe Gomez, and we're going to be hearing from Michael Bruhn about his book, Coming Clean, Breaking America's Addiction to Oil and Coal. Right now, I would like to welcome Anne Rakuya Robbins. She is the founder of the World Knowledge Bank, and she will be giving a talk titled Civilization as an Art Form on Wednesday, December 3rd from 6 to 8 in the evening at the Santa Fe Complex right here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
It's great to have you here. Now, let's talk first of all about the World Knowledge Bank. What is that all about?
It's an internet-based enterprise. And its essential mission is to value human life and life experience from any person living. So it's a very big tent kind of idea.
So when you talk about a bank, you talk about deposits and withdrawals. Is it really along those lines?
Yeah, in some ways it is. Essentially, people can deposit their knowledge from life experience, from the most basic things a person does in daily life to something very complex and esoteric. And they can elect to either gift it to the world or to deposit it in a marketplace where they can receive revenues for it.
What are some examples of that that are actually already up and running? By the way, the website is wkbank.com, so people can actually go visit it. What are some examples of how people are already using it?
Well, there are really three examples that I wanted to give you, two of which are on there and one which is not. But for example, let's say that you know something about how to drive through traffic in Santa Fe when it's rush hour, and you know how to get through town and in a quick amount of time. You can deposit that. That's out there. I think that's 50 cents.
So why would somebody want to pay 50 cents for that?
Well, that's a good idea. I mean, that's a good question, but people who have experience with something and have figured out by trial and error how to do something, that's very valuable to others. The key is if you could find that, it would be worth 50 cents to you rather than you having to figure it out yourself, trial and error. And in a funny way, it's life experience that's not been shared and valued so far. And this is really what you need to know, whether it's something as simple as driving through traffic, or let's say you want to go and you're going to have a job in an organization where there's a lot of dynamics that you might not know about. Could be very valuable to find out, what are the dynamics of how this community works? What are some of the obstacles? How can I work through this infrastructure and find a way to be successful in this workplace? That knowledge doesn't exist out there. Usually you have to trial and error it again. Another example is, this is more for the developing world, but let's say, you're an oyster farmer in the Philippines, and you, as they do there, you have a little slice of the river. It might be 15 feet wide and then across the river. Well, how can you, increase your well-being? One of the ways you can do it is by depositing what you've learned about oyster fishing, even though it's only a very small part of the river, and receive cash back for that. That's very, very valuable in economies where finding cash is very difficult.
Now, in third world economies, and you have a family connection to the Philippines, so you know a great deal more about it than I do, but are people surfing the internet for the knowledge that they need?
In many ways, they are. They use a lot more cell phones and text messaging than we do because infrastructure is still very expensive there to have a computer and so on. But, of course, the bank can be available in a mobile form as well as online with a desktop computer or laptop. And they're very intelligent, savvy. They're maybe more eager to use this new technology than many people are here because they know that they need to find new ways to provide income, which is very hard to find. And very tenacious, very ingenious, and very smart people. Survival makes people very smart. That's one of the messages of the World Knowledge Bank. We tend to think that if you're an academic or, you know, you've written a book, not that that's not also true, but in fact, having to scrounge for survival and figure out how to make do with very little makes you very ingenious and intelligent and smart. So that's one of the messages of the World Knowledge Bank. We need to value that much more than we have. Another example is I heard you some time ago kibitzing with one of somebody online, and you were saying, you know, I have all these ideas for screenplays, and here's one. Here's
me?
Two. Yeah, you were doing it, and I thought, you know, that's an exact...
Oh, those were the phony screenplays. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but they were good. I was liking these. And I thought, you know, that's the kind of thing you can deposit in the bank and either charge money or not. You can build it as a legacy. Maybe you want to give it to your children. Or maybe you want the income from that to go to some charity that you value. That's one way you can use the bank as well.
How is that different from the internet that already exists in this way? I mean, if I want to know anything at all, I Google and I find, you know, bits of knowledge and not just trivia, but, you know, how to do all sorts of things. If I want to know how to get rid of mice, if I want to know how to do anything, it's already there. How is this different from that?
Well, some of it is already there, but the internet is a very young, very fecund, if I can use that fancy word, place where a lot of things are possible. What isn't there now is a way for the average person to retain their rights, so to speak, to that knowledge and the potential to receive revenues. Almost all of the places that you're talking about, people donate that. And that's fine if that's what you want to do. Maybe you have a job someplace else, so you don't need the revenues. But for millions and millions of people around the world, they do need a new source of income. The World Knowledge Bank represents something very important. It's a new source of income for people that hasn't existed before. It's a little like when people first discovered mining, and they said, "Oh, well, we can do something else with this material." And so it's like a new form of wealth in the world. And some people want to give it away. That's great.
Now, if I am trying to find out how to do something, or I find out that it's on the World Knowledge Bank and it costs 25 cents or $100 or whatever, how am I to know that this knowledge is accurate?
Well, what do you mean by accurate?
Well,
you
in know, other words, if it's how to do something, how do I know that it's not just, that it's actually useful to me and that it's worth the money?
Well, I think there are a couple of answers to that. Everyone who deposits knowledge, it has to be from their own personal experience. Now, we don't guarantee that it's going to be useful to you. You have to find a way to integrate it. But let's say that you, and first of all, it's a very affordable domain. So things at the World Knowledge Bank are, for the most part, very affordable by American standards, $5, 50 cents, $10, could be more than that. But the other thing is, you may find a piece of it valuable. What the bank is really good at is helping people create more knowledge. So let's say, as I did, I figured out a way to heat tea water with the right timing, with the right cups, so that I didn't always burn my lips and my tongue with it being too hot and still being warm enough that by the time I was eating my breakfast, I could have it. Well, let's say that you find some of that useful and you try it, but you're in Rio de Janeiro instead of Santa Fe, where the elevation is different. You say, yeah, but if you're at sea level, change the timing. And you can deposit that, you can charge 10 cents, and you add. The real power of the bank is the way in which knowledge is created by adding pieces to one another.
So you are going to be giving a talk. We're talking to Anne Rakuya Robbins, who is the founder of the World Knowledge Bank, and she will be giving a talk called Civilization as an Art Form. That's on Wednesday, the 3rd of December, from 6 to 8 at the Santa Fe Complex on Agua Fria. Talk about that, civilization as an art form. What do you mean?
The beautiful thing about works of art is that you can start fresh. You kind of have permission and responsibility to do that. Often we think of civilization as something that is. It exists in a certain form, and only fools would try to change it. the truth is that it's always, in my opinion, been more or less an invention. There's nothing a priori about it. It's nothing given about it. So are we going to engage that opportunity, especially with the internet, create certain opportunities that did not exist before? Individual artists in the past have been able to create all kinds of wonderful things, but primarily as symbols, not as operating economies, for example. That's different now with the internet. And the World Knowledge Bank and its sister company, which is called the Santa Fe Knowledge Bank, which I'm introducing on Wednesday night also, is a new kind of economy that people can participate. In other words, you can function and live within this civilization that's created, that has been created, and it's based on certain principles, like all life has an intrinsically creative insight into living, and it's valuable, and you have a right to the revenues that are generated from that. One of the things that art can do, which is sometimes very difficult under other cultural domains, is to create new principles.
And what are some examples of that?
Well, the bank has a set of founding principles which are really central to its mission. And you get a chance, as someone that might want to participate in it, to look at that and say, do I agree with that? Do I believe in
that? What are some of those principles?
I mentioned the first one, that all life has an essentially creative insight into living, that each person has a right to the revenues generated from that knowledge. Now, that's very not true in the way our current civilization works. So when it's not true, you can often have a situation where individuals can find certain kinds of employment because corporations value it. And if corporate or corporate structure or other kinds of structures don't value what you know, you're out of luck, so to speak. You're not even valued. And so that sets up a kind of a feeling of being unappreciated, which in the long run creates a certain kind of hostility and anger. I'm attending a conference on human dignity and humiliation studies in New York City.
Dignity and humiliation studies.
Yes.
Wow.
This is a really important work. What it's about is that when you don't value people and you don't communicate that you value them, it creates a certain kind of hardness and a certain kind of anger and hostility that sometimes erupts sooner rather than later. And actually, the remedy to it is fairly simple. It is to be respectful of one another, to communicate that you value them. And nothing is more powerful than that, than being able to earn a living in a dignified way and make your way in the world. When some people, you know, can make $500 million, other people can't even make $15,000 in America, for example. Or if that, sometimes you can't even make that. There's a great despair that creates in people. And the remedy is not hard to figure out, actually. It's about the will to do it. And that's what I'm trying to do in this presentation. I'm also going to, you know, bring in some music that I've created and imagery, because it's a full body experience. It draws on all the senses. But the idea is that we can create another way of doing things, and we can do it now, and we can do it universally.
Civilization comes from the same etymology as cities. So civilization is about living in cities. It's about living close together. So, and it's something that everybody participates in. And when you talk about civilization as an art form and you start talking about the people being entitled to their revenues, it seems to me, I mean, you're getting into intellectual property questions and the whole nature of creation, which often isn't really individual. I mean, you might come up with something, or you and I and three other people might come up with something simultaneously or come up with it together. And so that ownership question does arise.
Well, there's a number of interesting things that you brought up. One is the idea of civilization coming from the root of cities. Actually, it's a little bit closer to communities. And I think that's a better way to look at it. And of course, in the world we live in today, distances have been removed, so that if you live in the rural area or the city, you know, you still are interconnected in very deep ways. As far as the ownership and copyright, of course, this is everything about that, no question about it. The real issue is, how are you going to decide on those rights? What kinds of rules are you going to put in place about who owns what? And one thing about natural language is that people rarely say the same thing exactly the same way twice. Now, why is that?
Is that true?
It is indeed true. It is indeed. And so that's one of the things about language that makes it so fun and engaging, is that everybody says it differently based on who they are and their life experience. Currently, we all have a unique history. We're connected and not. You know, we're similar and not. And that's the power that the bank tries to make a currency and make us allow us to be able to exchange. So you came from I don't know where, but you have a certain history, the East Coast, West Coast, I don't know. Same with me. My family came from the Pacific Northwest. So much of my mother was born in a log cabin in Idaho, if you can believe that, that her dad built. And she was born without a midwife. My grandmother gave birth to her while she had two other little children in tow. She cut the cord herself. I mean, you know, this is incredible kinds of experience.
And she almost grew up to be president.
And she almost, yeah, right. But it's one of the groups that have been, whose knowledge has been most lost and undervalued is women, girls and women. So this is a real important opportunity for women and girls around the world. And of course we want boys and men to have their voices heard as well. So, but a lot of knowledge, like my grandmother, I don't know how she did that. How did she know how to cut the cord, and how did she know how to take care of everything? And my grandfather was away helping a neighbor up there. You know, the doctor was 2 days away. It was winter. So how did she know how to survive?
It's funny. I got into a couple of different conversations with people at Santa Fe Complex and talked about how organizations based on technology like the complex, which is, it's not entirely based on computer technology, but it's a large part of it, tend to quickly become nerd boy tech clubs. I mean, with great respect to all the nerd boy tech people who are listening to the show right now, but that's what they become. And so here you're talking about the lost knowledge of women and girls using a medium that often it's not their medium.
Well, I think there hasn't been that much designed with them in mind yet. I mean, that's one of the things the bank is doing.
So how are you designing things with women and girls in mind? That's an interesting question.
Well, the World Knowledge Bank cares a lot about how people have integrated their daily lives, how they feel. One of the things that I'm most proud, if I can use that word, about the bank is that it's pioneered new subject matter. So knowledge of daily life, knowledge of how I feel, knowledge of how life feels for me. Knowledge of communities. How do I communicate to someone else that I value them? This is really an area that involves interacting with people closely.
And via computer.
Pardon?
Via computer.
Via computer.
But I mean, that's, you know, aren't all the social networking sites all about that?
They are not. In very many ways, they're not. And you don't retain, so to speak, ownership of that. So it's hard to build a legacy. One of the things the bank does is you can build over a lifetime. This is not something you use once and then leave behind. This is kind of a life companion, and you build a legacy which you can leave behind that's based on the challenges you faced, and nobody faces the same challenges you do. They may be similar, but they're not the same. I think sometimes in male-centered organizations, the technology can become too foregrounded, and the humanity becomes a little less foregrounded. Even to go out a little bit more on a limb, one of the things that science does is it tries to decipher principles and assumptions. It doesn't create them. So it's very hard often for science to lead, for science to innovate in certain kinds of human communities. So this is about valuing people, and when you communicate that by buying knowledge and and communicating that it's a value to you, something very important changes in people.
Anne Rakuya Robbins is the founder of the World Knowledge Bank, which is on the web at wkbank.com. She will be giving a talk titled Civilization as an Art Form on Wednesday, December 3rd from 6 to 8 in the evening at Santa Fe Complex, which is at 632 Agua Fria Street here in Santa Fe. And the phone number over there is 216.
That's my number, sorry.
Oh, okay. I don't know what the number is over there, but you can find it on the web at sfcomplex.com. And Anne, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome poets Gabe Gomez and Michelle LaFlamme Childs. They are going to be doing a poetry reading on Wednesday, December 3rd at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Hi, thanks.
Hey, how you doing?
Since we just have a few minutes today, I thought maybe each of you could read a poem or two.
Well, that'd be great.
It's perfect.
Who wants to go first?
Michelle, great.
I guess that's me then.
Excellent.
All right, this is a poem called Robes, about a recurring dream I had as a child, actually. Robes. Adrift, a new insignificance awaits escape in crickets and dreams. Once abducted, swaddled in ermine, luxurious moss of mind caresses fresh skin. A new significant spun of ego-hardened gems gleams from pale, shrouded eyes, illuminating an empty dollhouse and a plastic Mickey Mouse record player. Weedy self-worth wills the night to infinity in vain. Another cycle ends with bird songs and unwrapped vision.
Gabe, how about you? Would you like to read a poem?
Sure. This is called Ruin in My Name. If we had stayed to watch the dunes disappear, or pretended to have gone to any place quieted by the outer light, the brunt of our exposition falling between the sloughs of eroded sledge route, our words pecking sound from the ether, a past tense where we decide order and volume, where the high rains leapt from that mountain, where math, height, that was never quite as congruous to the imagined. I would have read the freshly burned truck chassis, filled in by the creases of the sand, with an early vocabulary, whose flames lapped in the curvature of the steel slabs, never erasing, if not amplifying, the shell, the exhilaration, and the voices of those boys driving into the night, their faces illuminated by irradiant dials, their hard breath blooming forgiveness and regret from the trills of blistering paint that came with the twilight. I wonder about the things that we would draw from them, how they left with an orchestral idea of searching, only to return with stolen trucks, recalcitrant, angered by their new voices booming from the desert in ruin.
Gabe Gomez here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Michelle LaFlamme Childs, would you like to do another one?
I can do another one. This one is A Tangle Down Her Legs. Oh, big air, oh, small death, oh, all alone, oh, too fast, oh, dark, oh, bad words, oh, invisible snakes, oh, left out, oh, no stories tonight, oh, bad dreams. Tangles burst into muscle and sinew, sewing in fear inescapable in a gash second of terror. Still new and elastic, she will soon appear again untangled, though scabs of innocence are formed and lost with each new episode.
Michelle LaFlamme Childs, let's just go back and forth.
That sounds good. This one's called Before the Common Era. There are evenings when the rickety egrets fork the rutted mud, one leg adrift, now and again these profane minutes contour the wetted stride. Air is stimulant to their crooked hunting. Under moon, an egg, male and female, a music embodies their wandering. One would think that they perch at night, heads in their billowing wings, but they too are sleepless, driven into hours of slow arrests, abrupt beginnings, postulate at once, revving to thrust at once, wait, and their sculpted angles erupt from the pecking, a nightcrawler eviscerated in the bird's throat, a swimmer stressing the fluid surface. You ran to the dictionary when I made up a word, looking pleased, you refuted its meaninglessness, read up on the very question that awakened you. Angled geese afloat in the second ocean, disrupted at the foreign body, ambling through the darkened water, find patterns in the mayhem, from patterns in their flight. Confront the disorder, for order it is.
Michelle Laflamme Childs and Gabe Gomez are poets who will be reading on Wednesday, December 3rd at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. That's on West San Francisco Street in Santa Fe, right across the street from the Lenzik. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
I love just reading aloud. It's great.
It's like a guerrilla poetry. Just coming in and just, okay, thanks, bye.
There we have it, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome, joining us by telephone, Michael Brune. He is the executive director of the Rainforest Action Network, and he's author of the new book, Coming Clean, Breaking America's Addiction to Oil, published by Sierra Club Books. And he will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore in Santa Fe on Thursday, December 4th at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Let's talk about the costs of oil extraction in terms of the rainforest, the Amazon rainforest. The costs are both environmental and cultural. Let's start with the actual health detriments of oil extraction, of that process itself.
Sure. Well, the process of extracting oil is a dirty one from the point of extraction all the way through to the point of combustion, really. If you look at every link in the oil supply chain from where we're drilling it to how we refine oil and the transportation of oil and then when it's finally burned, there are very serious, a whole range of environmental impacts, including very serious human health and impacts on the local environment. Probably the best case study right now can be found in the Amazon in Ecuador, where Texaco, which is now owned by Chevron, spilled hundreds of millions of gallons of oil over a period of several decades. That has caused very severe birth defects and developmental disorders and startling mutations in the local human population, as well as an impact on plant and animal species down in Ecuador over a period of more than 20 years. I open up this book by detailing a trip that we took down to southern Ecuador near the Peruvian border, where another oil company, now owned by ConocoPhillips, was attempting to drill on native territory. Fortunately, those drilling plans have been shelved for now, but almost everywhere around the world where you look at the extraction of oil, you'll always find a series of very negative consequences for the local population.
And then where oil is refined, there's some bad stuff going on there too.
Yes, and here in the United States, 90 million Americans live within a 30-mile radius of an oil refinery, which is the radius in which the pollution has been documented to have an impact on the health of people living in the area. Most of those communities are low-income communities. They're often communities of color. And we're talking about one-third of the population lives within this range of an oil refinery. So once again, when we think about the cost of oil, many of us think about the price of a gallon of gas. We might think about impacts on human rights, but really oil has a very serious social and environmental impact throughout the entire supply chain.
What happens ecologically when the rainforest is damaged? And, as you, the director of the Rainforest Action Network, can tell us more about, it's not just due to oil extraction. There's a lot of other factors that have to do with cutting down the forest. But what happens when you damage the rainforest?
Well, it depends on the ecology of a region. But what is commonly known is that the soils in rainforests are very thin. They're very poor. And so it's awfully difficult for a rainforest to replenish itself, which makes the tragedy that much more profound. When we're clearing a rainforest, whether it's for wood or for oil or for large agriculture operations, soy plantations or palm oil plantations, it's very, very difficult for those rainforests to come back. And often they're destroyed permanently and converted into some type of industrial development or industrial extraction. We know, of course, that rainforests are the lungs of the earth and that they provide habitat for half of the world's plant and animal species and almost half of the world's medicines. But what we don't know is that when we degrade these rainforests, They are, even though they're very vibrant ecosystems, it's very difficult for them to withstand any type of severe degradation, which makes it all the more important that we address climate change, because our extraction and combustion of fossil fuels is arguably the biggest threat to rainforests globally over the next 50 years.
As you write about in the book, we know that over the last 8 years, but much longer than that, there has been a strong political influence of oil on the political process, the oil industry, leading to subsidies, leading to all sorts of good treatment of the oil industry, often at the expense of the public and alternative energy industries. How can this be ended, changed, transformed? And do you think things can change under the Obama administration?
I think these things could change under the Obama administration. I think that they could change under any administration right now. And certainly with Obama in the White House, there is very good reason to have a lot of hope for our future. But in order to make progress, we have to have a very clear, realistic assessment of the problem. And that's that under every administration since President Nixon, we have had our president or leaders in Congress talk about wanting to break our dependence on oil and wanting to reduce America's consumption of foreign oil. And under every administration, our consumption of oil has increased, and the percentage of that consumption that's coming from foreign sources has also increased. So what we see is nearly every political leader in either political party talking a very, very good game in very compelling terms about how it's patriotic and it's good for the country and it's good for our economy to reduce our dependence on oil. And yet the policies that those administrations and those Congresses support will have invariably deepened our dependence on oil. And as you point out, one of the key ways to test whether or not an administration or Congress is serious is the degree to which they're subsidizing different energy industries. You can follow the money, of course. Right now, the U.S. government subsidizes oil to the tune of about $50 billion each year. This is according to a research group called EarthTrack. So $50 billion each year goes to the richest industry in the history of the world, an industry that has been doing quite well, particularly over the last several years. And when we think about how we can redirect that money and how we can reinvest it in energy efficiency or solar power, wind power, bailing out Detroit in a way that guarantees we'll have higher fuel economy, when you think about the potential of redirecting $50 billion, there's actually a lot of hope that we can seize this new political moment as a great opportunity to redirect our funds towards something that's that genuinely would make progress on a very persistent challenge.
We're talking to Michael Bruhn of the Rainforest Action Network and author of the book Coming Clean, Breaking America's Addiction to Oil and Coal. Well, let's talk about coal. Is there such a thing as clean coal? It sounds like an oxymoron.
Well, I think that if you believe in clean coal, you're probably very likely to also believe in the Tooth Fairy and the Easter Bunny and that coal can be mined by little leprechauns.
Uh-oh.
You know, and nothing against the Tooth Fairy or the Easter Bunny and leprechauns. The reality is that there literally is no such thing as clean coal. There's not a single coal plant in the country that could be called clean. There's not a single coal plant even under construction in the United States that would be able to capture and store all of its greenhouse gas emissions, placing them underground, monitoring them so that they couldn't impact our climate. And when you look at the potential for the technology, the barriers to developing an industry, a coal industry, that would be able to even just address its greenhouse gas emissions are so severe and so significant that it becomes clear that it's much better for the United States to redirect its money and to go all in for clean energy instead. So, for example, what I mean by that is that if utilities wanted to capture their greenhouse gas emissions from a smokestack, it would raise the cost of coal by about 50 to 100%. This is according to MIT. In order to create enough energy to capture and store all of those greenhouse gas emissions from coal plants, we would have to build one new coal plant for every 3 coal plants already in existence.
Oh, boy.
So we'd have to build more coal plants, create more greenhouse gas emissions just to create enough energy to capture the emissions from the coal plants that were already in existence. And think of all of that more coal mining and all of the transportation of coal and the waste that comes from coal at the same time.
Well, let's talk about that. There's something called mountaintop coal mining. What is it and what are its effects?
Okay, so there's lots of different types of mining. There's most people, when they think of coal mining, they think of underground shafts, big caverns, coal miners going down under the ground and pulling out tons of coal, black lung disease. That is still a very common form of mining. And in fact, more than 10,000 Americans miners have died from black lung disease in just the last decade alone. Then there's large strip mines, which have evolved into strip mines that you'll see in the Powder River Basin, which is one of the largest coal seams in the country up in Wyoming. And then there's mountaintop removal, which rather than take the coal out from underneath a mountain in Appalachia, what coal companies like Massey Energy and others are doing is removing the mountain literally off of the coal by blowing up an entire mountain. 2/3 of all explosive use in the country is for coal mining today.
Wow.
And in Appalachia, 400, almost 500 now, mountains have been completely leveled, completely destroyed, just to get the coal underneath. And when the mountain is blown up piece by piece, all of the dirt and rubble and trees is just dumped over the side of the mountain into the valley below, burying about 1,200 miles of streams throughout Appalachia.
There's a lot more to talk about in all of these subjects, but let's talk about, because this is the direction that your book is going, what would a post-oil, post-coal economy and infrastructure look like? And is anyone in a more progressive country than this already doing it?
Sure. Well, just one more note on coal. Just to put the challenge in perspective, coal is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the country. It's the fastest growing source of greenhouse gas emissions on the planet. It's also the largest source of mercury poisoning in the country. Burning coal creates 3 times more toxic solid waste than all of the municipal garbage in the country combined. And according to the American Lung Association, 24,000 Americans die prematurely each year from pollution from coal-fired power plants. So it's a huge challenge. It's a huge challenge. The good news is that, you know, and to answer your question directly, the future, the post-fossil fuel economy in the United States, what it will look like is one that where efficiency is placed at the top of the agenda. In California in the 1970s, after the first energy crisis and because of very good leadership here in the state, led primarily by Jerry Brown, California invested in a whole series of initiatives on energy efficiency to the extent that today your average resident in California uses about half of the energy as a typical resident does in the rest of the country. And, of course, you know, we have a flourishing economy, 7th largest economy in the world, and it's not a state that's known for its restraint in any way. You know, people in California, by and large, are living quite well with a very efficient energy system. Many other countries, particularly in Western Europe, are even more efficient than California is. So a post-fossil fuel economy will use energy much more efficiently and at the same time save lots of money and create more jobs by retrofitting houses, weatherizing homes, building more appliances or materials, or using building automobiles that use significantly less energy.
Still, we need electricity. Yeah. Can other sources like solar and wind replace coal and nuclear and the other electricity sources that we depend on right now?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's look at the problem very clearly. Right now in the United States, about 49%, just under 50% of our electricity, our power, comes from coal. Nuclear provides about 20% of U.S. electricity. Natural gas provides another 20%. And geothermal, hydro, wind, and solar provide the remaining 10 to 11%. what we're seeing is that the amount of power supplied by coal is going down in very small increments over the last several years. It was at 52% 2 or 3 years ago, 49% today, whereas solar and wind are increasing dramatically. There was 3 times more wind capacity, new wind, that was added in 2007 than new coal. And the solar industry is growing at about 40, 42, 45% year after year after year for several years running now. So both those industries are growing dramatically. Fossil fuels is either remaining steady or slightly declining. The good news is that as the price of coal is increasing each year, or the price to build new coal plants is also increasing, the price of getting power from the sun or power from the wind or from geothermal is decreasing steadily. The price of getting power from wind has dropped by 90% in the last 20 years. 90% in the last 20 years.
That's amazing.
And so what you're having is this great transition where heavy and dirty fossil fuels are starting to we're starting to get to the point where we can not just stop the coal industry from expanding, but to begin to contract the industry and retire old and dirty coal plants and replace them with big solar facilities, large concentrated solar facilities, or big wind farms throughout the Midwest and Southwest.
We're talking to Michael Brune. His book is called Coming Clean, Breaking America's Addiction to Oil and Coal. I want to stop for a moment on the word addiction and ask what you mean by that. I mean, there's an analogy to substance abuse, which I wonder whether it's a proper analogy, because, I mean, oil and coal and so on are vehicles for doing things that we want to do and need to do, like go to work and travel and so on, which aren't inherently harmful, mm-hmm. and they're, in fact, good things. I mean, is there anything wrong with our lifestyle in itself, or just the fuels we use to power it?
Well, it's an interesting question. You know, I had a lot of conversations with people about this. The addiction theme was probably most famously used by our current president, George Bush, who
right.
stood up at the State of the Union 3.5 years ago and said America is addicted to oil. And I think that it's if you look at our country or our economy, I think that analogy is quite true, that our society is dependent on oil and coal and dirty energy to function. And it's been very difficult to make any significant and substantial progress to break that addiction. However, as individuals or businesses, I don't think that individuals are addicted to oil per se or addicted to coal. We have all become dependent on transportation, or we have become dependent on electricity. I go home and I flick the light switch. I come into my office and I turn on my computer, and I'm not dependent on coal for that. I don't desire coal in great quantities, or I don't need oil when I drive my car necessarily. My lifestyle has become dependent on getting conveniently from one place to the next. And right now, oil is the fuel that enables that to happen. And I've become dependent on my family's ability to turn the lights on at night, or to have a refrigerator that works or a radio player that works. And depending on where you live in the country, a lot of that comes a lot of electricity comes from coal. So I think that it is true that individual lifestyle changes will help this issue. I think that many of us can be more frugal and efficient in how we consume as individuals and what we consume as individuals. But I wrote this book really because I think that what we need is more systemic change, and we need to work collectively to achieve that systemic change. I think that we can eat organic food, but all of the organic strawberries and watermelons in the world won't really have an impact on the globalized food system. And we can change our light bulbs, and we can fill up the tires in our car, and that's it's good to do that. It's important to do that. but it's also insufficient to do that. We can't stop at changing our own lifestyles. We have to organize collectively to achieve more political, more substantive political victories than we've been able to achieve. So this book is really oriented towards how we can work together to achieve that, to have a deeper impact. And a lot of what I talk about in the book is what we've done at Rainforest Action Network, organizing around the country to convince Home Depot to stop selling wood from ancient forests, for example, or to convince Citi or Bank of America to stop financing or bankrolling bulldozers in the Amazon. It's that kind of systemic, collective, collaborative work that I think is where we can have the biggest impact on clean energy and really on any issue.
I think that there are some individual actions that people take that might not even on an individual level they work, but on a collective level they don't. Hybrid cars are one example of that. They use less gas, that's great, but their total carbon footprint is far worse than many conventional cars, and nobody seems to know that.
Well, I haven't seen that data that the carbon footprint of hybrid cars are worse than you know, a comparable other new car. If that if someone were to buy a hybrid, their footprint would be higher than buying a similar sedan.
Actually seem to be true, but we don't have to talk about it right now. I'm going to do a program on it sometime in the future. But another example is biofuels. I mean, biofuels, they come out of the ground. Are they, when you look at the big picture, are they good for the world or not?
They're almost always they're not. And I want to make 2 points on this. So for biofuels specifically, a lot of data has come out over the last year to 3 years saying that in almost every instance, biofuels create more problems than they're trying to solve. If you look at it from a perspective just strictly about climate change, biofuels create more greenhouse gases than conventional oil. If we thought gas and oil was a problem in fueling our cars, if we replace our gas with ethanol, corn-based ethanol, we're creating more greenhouse gases than conventional oil. Or if we're filling it with biodiesel coming from palm oil from cleared rainforests in Indonesia, for example, we can be creating up to 10 times more greenhouse gases than conventional oil. And then when you factor in other issues such as the fact that we're clearing rainforests to grow crops, which are then used to produce fuel, which then power our cars, we get to just a level of absurdity at trying to solve problems and creating a series of other problems that it boggles the mind at times. One other point on biofuel specifically is that perhaps the biggest danger is that in order to grow these fuels, we're displacing food crops. So what we literally have is we have automobiles competing with people for fuel, for food. And for those who are at the, as Lester Brown likes to say, for those people who are at the bottom rung of society in terms of personal wealth and access to resources, those people who are surviving on $1 or $2 a day, those folks are the most put at risk when food crops are being displaced in order to grow biofuels. But the larger point that I wanted to make on this is just that in order to transform our transportation system, there's a series of things that we can do that some of which can be done in the next 6 months. Very, very practical, pragmatic, and powerful things that could be done at the state and federal level to address how much oil that we're using in transportation and to make significant progress there. And then there are other things that can be done over the next 3 to 4 years, and then some things will take several decades to do. Over the next 6 to 12 months, at the state level and federal level, particularly at the federal level, there will be a massive bill coming through Congress in 2009 that will impact how much money is invested in the U.S. in new roads, new bridges, highway construction versus the money that's being devoted to bike lanes, high-speed rail, buses, trains, all different forms of mass transit or non-polluting forms of transit, and how those equations are developed and the proportion of money that goes towards sustainable transportation will be very powerful and a very important way for activists to engage to reduce our dependence on cars. which I think is a key component of that. Over the next several years, the fact remains that many people do need cars to get around. If you're living in a city, if you're here in San Francisco, a lot of my friends don't need cars. Or maybe they'll do a car share and get a car for the weekend occasionally, but they don't need cars. For lots of people around the country, though, that's just not a practical option to get to work or to get to school or to church or to go shopping. Right. It's very difficult to survive without an automobile. And so step one is focusing on investments in mass transit. Step two is focusing on building cars that are more fuel efficient and electrifying transportation while we green the grid, building more plug-in hybrid cars and then fully electric vehicles.
But then go ahead. We've got just another 30 seconds.
All right.
Go ahead.
So then the third step is back to reducing our dependence on cars altogether, which is redesigning our towns and communities so that where we live and where we shop and where we go to church and where we play are closer together so that we're not dependent on a car to get from A to B to C to D. It's a complex problem, but there are solutions at every step.
Michael Bruhn is Executive Director of the Rainforest Action Network and author of the new book, Coming Clean, Breaking America's Addiction to Oil, published by Sierra Club Books, and he will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore in Santa Fe on Thursday, December 4th at 6 o'clock. And Rainforest Action Network can be found on the web at ran.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want. Thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Jazz a la Carta. Broadcasting live, broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company. My name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta la vista. Bye.